Translation: the Brahmanas represent his mouth, the Kshatriyas his arms, the Vaishyas his thighs, and the Shudras are born of his legs. So if you see our slide, our PowerPoint show, we have this nice picture of a Brahmana we found someplace on the internet doing puja, like that. Okay, then Prabhupada's purport. All living beings are stated to be the parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord. All living beings are stated to be the parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord. And now, how they are so is explained in this verse. So when I was thinking this, I had a little bit of problem to work this out, because parts and parcels of Krishna, then we kind of think more like a very more ontological sense. Like, you know, we're all parts of the Ras dance or something like that. So here's talking about parts and parcels, but in terms of the bodies of the living entities, the embodied living entities, and the Lord's objective material body, the Virat Purush, Virat Rupa. So all living beings are situated, are stated to be parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord, and how they are so is explained in this verse. Okay, and here it is. The four divisions of human society, namely the intelligent class, the Brahmanas, the administrative class, the Kshatriyas, the mercantile class, the Vaishyas, and the laborer class, the Shudras, are all in different parts of the body of the Lord. Okay. Now again, of course, this means the body of the jiva. And as such, no one is differentiated from the Lord. The mouth of the body and the legs of the body are different, are non-different. And the Brahmanas and Shudras, constitutionally, they are non-different. But the mouth or the head of the body is qualitatively more important than the legs. At the same time, the mouth, the legs, the arms, and thighs are all component parts of the body. These limbs of the body of the Lord are meant to serve the complete whole. So this is the point that Prabhupada is making in the purport. It just says that they all compose these things. But here's Prabhupada's focusing on this point, that they're all a part of the same body. And they're really not different. Like, you know, an apple is different than an orange. But an apple tree is not different from the apple fruit. You know, you can't separate them and have them have their existence. You know, one has to grow from the other. One has to nourish the other. One has to be reproductive cause of the other. Okay. So the Shudras, Brahmanas, and Kshatriyas, they're all part of the same body. But then Prabhupada says, if you look at it, okay, there is a qualitative difference. Then Prabhupada goes on. The mouth is meant for speaking, right? He's going to talk about the Brahmana, and eating. So these are two functions of the mouth, speaking and eating. The arms are meant for protecting the body. Yeah? The legs are meant for carrying the body. And the waist is meant for maintaining the body. It's very nice. The Brahmanas are supposed to speak and eat. Kshatriyas are supposed to protect the body. The Vaishyas are supposed to maintain us. And the Shudras are meant for carrying everything. Okay, slide number 7. The intelligent class in society, okay, now we're going to talk about the Brahmanas first, therefore must speak on behalf of the body, as well as accept foodstuff to satisfy the hunger of the body. It's not, this Prabhupada says in the Krishna book, the Brahmana is supposed to eat a nice halava dripping with ghee, you know, and not give any kind of information or teach anything. The hunger of the body, the hunger of the Lord, is to accept the fruits of sacrifice. The Brahmanas, or the intelligent class, must be very expert performing such sacrifices. And the subordinate classes must join in such sacrifices. So the Brahmanas, as being the mouth of the Lord, and this, it means that they may not even actually enjoy the food. You know, the mouth is chewing it and getting it to the rest of the body. But here the Brahmanas are supposed to be the mouth, like by arranging Harinam Sankirtan, by arranging deity worship, by arranging different fire sacrifices, by arranging marriages and these kind of things, which are also sacrifices. So they're supposed to function as the mouth of the Lord, and it's not that they're supposed to eat and enjoy so much. It's part of the process. To speak for the Lord means to glorify the Lord by means of propagating the knowledge of the Lord as it is, broadcasting the factual nature of the Lord and the factual position of all other parts of the whole body. So this is our job. You know, the Brahmana should be able to propagate the knowledge. You know, who is Krishna? What is his position? What is our position in terms of him? The Brahmanas, therefore, are required to know the Vedas, okay, or the ultimate source of knowledge. Here goes slide number 8. Veda means knowledge, and Anta means the end of it. According to Bhagavad Gita, the Lord is the source of everything. Aham Sarvasya Parabala. Okay. That, of course, is verse number 10:8, the first of the 4 nutshell verses. And thus, the end of all knowledge, Vedanta, is to know the Lord, to know our relationship with him, and to act according to that relationship only. Yeah. Just cool. So kind of like sambandha avideya, but maybe no prayojana exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and the Vedas and Vedanta talk about prayojana so much. Yeah, to know the Lord, he's the supreme, he's the cause of all causes. Our relationship is that we're part and parcel of him. We're not going to become him, so we should serve him. And then to act according to that relationship, okay, we have a whole process of religion, of varnashram, of vaidhi bhakti. Yeah. And then there's a result, which is, of course, that we awaken our prema in different transcendental spiritual aspects. So it seems that here, you know, being part and parcel of the Lord, all being part of the body of the Lord, is really just focusing on the virat rupa and the embodied living entities, not talking about our esoteric position. The human life is especially, public goes on, the parts of the body are related to the body. Similarly, the living being must know his relationship with the Lord. Human life is especially meant for this purpose, namely to know the factual relationship of every living being with the Supreme Lord. Without knowing this relationship, the human life is spoiled. And you can go to slide number 9 then. The intelligent class of men, the Brahmanas, are therefore especially responsible for broadcasting this knowledge of our relationship with the Lord and leading the general mass of people to the right path. So we got a very, very nice little picture we like, and it shows one clown with 4 different kinds of dogs all, you know, marching and dancing on their hind legs together. And so you kind of think of Srila Prabhupada, all of us in ISKCON, Srila Prabhupada's dogs. And there are big dogs and fancy dogs and little dogs. You know. But the clown is leading everybody on the right path. So Prabhupada, give you God. Okay, section number 10. Then Prabhupada goes to the administrative class, which is meant for protecting the living beings so that they can serve this purpose. So it should be clear. Otherwise, you know, the Kshatriyas, for example, try to start messing around in philosophy so they can actually adjust things for their satisfaction or things like that. But no, the Brahmanas should be, you know, doing their job, and Kshatriyas basically should find Brahmanas they respect, Brahmanas who they love and, you know, can take care of them. And then they protect them, protect society. The mercantile class is meant for producing food grains and distributing them to the complete human society so that the whole population is given a chance to live comfortably and discharge the duties of human life. The mercantile class is also required to give protection to the cows in order to get sufficient milk and milk products, which alone can give the proper health and intelligence to maintain a civilization perfectly meant for knowledge of the absolute truth, the ultimate truth. So this is one brings to our mind that is one point now that even several devotees are starting to take to a vegan diet. You know, it's an interesting topic in our understanding at this point. We're always trying to learn more about things. Is that, then yes, you know, we should try to minimize, if nothing else, minimize our consumption of milk in terms of reducing the animal slaughter that goes on. Because, of course, almost all the milk we get comes from cows who are, in first place, they're tormented and tortured horribly just simply to produce more milk, and they die at a very early age and something like that. It's just unbelievable the kind of torture that the cows go through to increase the milk production. Other places, and there are different dairies like that. You know, in California, for example, devotees would buy their milk from Clover Dairy because they were Christian people, and they took care of the cows nicely. But in the end, they also, you know, sent them down the road, you know, when they weren't productive. You know, so but there are some places that do retire the cows. And even studies like that, one devotee, Mark Chatburn, as you remember, he did his master's thesis on this. And he did like a, you know, little survey, maybe like 200 people, 400 people. How much more would you be willing to pay if you knew that the cows that you're getting milk from were actually being retired rather than killed? You know, and maybe a couple little description of the quality, the improved quality of the milk, too, because of that. And maybe if milk cost like a dollar normally, people were willing to pay like $1.40 or something like that. Maybe like 40% more than they were willing to pay if just because they knew the cows were being retired. And that means, okay, that's 40% more than the farmers that could actually go through it. You have to take care of the cows and retire them properly. And in many cases, the farmers themselves don't like it. They don't like killing the animals. They deal with them. It's very difficult not to see them as people, at least to some degree. Because that's one aspect, yes, that we try to minimize milk intake because, you know, the slaughter involved like that. Another aspect, though, is that it's describing that the rishis would live in the forest on fruits and roots and leaves. So in those circumstances, not for a child but an adult, you know, can live with very little milk, maybe just some festivals or something like that, and be very purified in his existence and, you know, very fine and peaceful. But then if one has to be a brahmana who's giving advice to the king and involved in all this process, then the brain requires more lactose, more of these fats that occur pretty much only in the cow's milk. Because you know, if you're working with your intelligence, you don't require so much mental, what they call it, brain power. But a brahmana who's working more with his mind, brains, then it takes more energy, more prana, more ghee in that respect. And so if you want to be a preacher, a sankirtan devotee, and get out there in the field and actually, you know, confront people and have, you know, mental battles with people to defeat maya, then you're going to have to take cow's milk. You know, stuff like that, to have the brain strength, you know, to fight. You know? Yeah. And, of course, the mental strength and stuff coming from the cow's milk, you know, you can even directly feel it. Otherwise, yeah, you get headaches and stuff of trying to do this work. You know? Okay, another point that we'll come back later on, probably. But that's kind of our basic understanding that, yes, you know, to do... Oh, yeah. And then the best way to protect the cows... to establish this thing is a Sankirtan movement, Prabhupada says. As a Sankirtan movement changes, people will change at heart. Without that, it would be very difficult to establish it. This is a change of heart. So therefore, you know, taking from the cows some milk to use for the benefit of the cows is a very, very natural process like that. But if we're not engaged in this kind of work, then how much do we need? We don't need to engage in a lot of, you know, expensive milk, sweets, and everything else, just for our sense gratification, realizing that it's not at the cost of murdering so many cows. Okay. The mercantile class is also required to give protection to the cows in order to get sufficient milk and milk products, which alone can give the proper health and intelligence to maintain a civilization perfectly meant for knowledge of the ultimate truth. Okay, number 11. And the laborer, English is a Spanish language, the laborer class, who are neither intelligent nor powerful, which is Brahmanas and Kshatriyas, can help by physical services to the higher classes and thus be benefited by their cooperation. Therefore, the universe is a complete unit in relationship with the Lord. Therefore, the universe is a complete unit in relationship with the Lord. And without this relationship with the Lord, the whole human society is disturbed and is without any peace and prosperity. This is confirmed in the Vedas. Brahmano shyamukam asin bahu rajanya krita. So, of course, it's interesting where that quotation comes from. I don't know. But it seems to be saying the same thing. The brahmanas are the mouth, and the arms are made of the kshatriyas. Okay. So, that's the end of our, what we got here? That's the end of our little commentary on the verse. So, anybody have any specific questions or comments right now? And then we have some more points we can make, unless anybody has any comments or questions right now.
Maharaj, can you give me a minute to unmute everybody?
So, Dandavats, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
So, Ito Gamadava Das here. An incredible purport. We, on some level, have some service to perform in Varnashram Dharma according to this purport. We're all part of the body of the Lord. It's a beautiful purport. But, and I liked your class, but one thing you said kind of struck me, that we should minimize our intake of milk. And a few things come to mind. We have some cow protection here on the Big Island with Dayal Chandra and Mangala's family. And if anyone has a situation where they know some farmers or some devotees that are taking care of cows, which is not the norm, unfortunately, we should have rural communities at this point, but for some reason, that isn't happening, at least in large parts of America. And, you buy local, or you support the devotees or the farmers that are dealing with the cows properly. That's one way that you can do it. And another idea is, even though there's a lot of abuses and it's a cruel industry and they're not dealing with the cows properly, by boycotting the milk, I mean, is that really going to affect a change? Or one devotee years ago said, should we abandon these cows and not offer their milk to Krishna? Then their lives are completely lost. Then they have no, they don't fit into, the devotional world, at all. They just have to suffer, their lives without their milk being offered.
So, very nice point. I was kind of thinking like that too. My only point was kind of like, if we're just satisfying our lust by eating a lot of ice cream and this and that stuff and so forth and so on, then that's not necessary. And so maybe we're artificially increasing the amount of milk necessary, and because of that, artificially, there's going to be more money, you know, for cows and slaughtering them. You know, it's complicated, as I was saying. So your point, very, very nice. As I was thinking, it's okay to just take what milk we need and use it for Krishna's service. And like you say, engage it all for Krishna's service, and then automatically the cows will benefit, and we'll have strength then, mental strength to preach.
Right. Yeah, Prabhupada, in different places, he called it a miracle food. I feel the difference when I'm taking milk and when I'm not taking milk.
And also, towards the fact, though, that there's, I mean, for the cows are being, you know, they put them in iron cages, they move them from here to there. It's just unbelievable. They die like in 7 years rather than 25 years. And people tell me that there's a certain level of acceptable level of pus, you know, what the U.S. government establishes in the milk, because the animals are just so disturbed that some of the milk we're getting is like really toxic, you know, compared to the other milk. So there's a big variety in the dairies.
Right, you have to be intelligent. You know, even the homogenization has ruined it, basically. It's bizarre that across the board they've decided, you know, the dairy associations decided to spin up the milk in such a way that the fat isn't digestible, or it causes problems. And their way out is 1%, 2%, you know, or non-fat milk. That's how they adjust it, but... Yeah, there's a lot of... So you have to be intelligent. Yeah, you have to be selective about what you're doing. Prabhupada Dwaitamaraj in South America, he's got something called the Spoon Revolution, and his cow seva is turning vegetarians, you know, turning people into vegetarians. And then he feels like he's saving cows that way.
Yeah, we have a lot of content in this program. South America, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's the word I'm looking for? We sponsor a couple of cows at Balabhadra's farm, and he sends a regular publication out, and he came here and visited us in Hawaii about a year or so ago, and gave and it really got me thinking along the lines of what Maharaj was saying, that we really have to, you know, consider the plight, the torturous condition these cows are put under. The big point he made was, you know, okay, maybe in the beginning, 40 years ago, when Prabhupada was talking about the importance of protecting the cow and cow protection, and okay, so maybe for now the practical thing is to buy the milk and et cetera, et cetera. But the point that he makes, and he makes a point really strong. I'm actually looking for the most recent publication, but I can't find it. I want to read what he said, but it's not somewhere around here. I can't find it. But he just makes a very, very strong case about blood milk. That, you know, hey, after 40 years, I mean, how much longer are we going to just sit back and say, okay, well, you know, it's Kali Yuga, what can we do? But it's torture right from the very beginning. As soon as a cow is, of course, their insemination almost always is AI, artificial insemination. And then as soon as the calf is born, which is, I don't think any of us, I certainly don't have the full feel for it, but when that calf is almost immediately taken away from the mother, which is devastating to the mother and devastating to the calf, I mean, it's torture all the way through. So, anyway, we're pretty much vegans, and you know, everybody's making good points. I also appreciate Vidugda's point that... you know, milk is really healthy. It's a great thing to take, but then again, we're also making the same point that how healthy is the milk really if we're drinking commercial milk. So, anyway, I'm just throwing out that other side that we've really tried to minimize practically stop any use of milk. But when, if and when we can ever get the healthy milk, Ramananda Prabhu brought us over some wonderful milk from the Big Island. And God, that was just like, it was like right out of Vaikuntha. It was right from Vrindavan. It seemed like it was right from Vrindavan. It's such wonderful, so wonderful. But anyway, I'm just throwing out the point that I was appreciating what Maharaj is saying, that we, at minimum, we should definitely minimize, you know, unnecessary taking of milk, because it's just so torturous to the cows.
Well, I mean, you're just reinforcing that idea.
That's it. I'm just reinforcing what
right,
I'm just agreeing
yeah,
with
both sides. Basically,
side.
You're taking that side, and I'm saying, you know, you could go a little deeper. You're just scratching the surface here. And, you know, you can use your intelligence to locate some milk that isn't that, of, you know, that people are taking better care of the cows and support that.
I agree. I agree completely. We're all on the same page.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as a footnote, when we were in Vrindavan 3 years ago, we were playing bhajans at the Mughal Mandir, and it was a big, big party organized by Sadhu Maharaj, and he invited one of the goshalas to provide the milk. It was hot milk that they came and served in clay pots to the guests. And if you drink that milk from Vrindavan, from the goshala cows, it was intoxicating. It was truly intoxicating. Mm. It was amazing. Hot milk from the goshala cows in Vrindavan, taken care of by the devotees, by Brijabasis. It was amazing. I mean, I didn't expect it, because I don't even drink milk anymore. It's like, milk, I know, is toxic, so I don't even drink it in the West. But if you actually drink milk from Vrindavan, from the goshalas, where the Brijabasis take care of those cows, I mean, it's just incredible.
Jai.
Well, again, the wonderful milk that Ramananda brought over, I think it was Ramanandaji, I don't remember where that milk came from. I thought it was one of the devotees, but God, it was wonderful. And I'd love to have it from Vrindavan. That's got to be the ultimate. But boy, it was, you know, like I said, I'm essentially a vegan. But if and when it's possible to get good, healthy milk, boy, it, as you're all saying, it's wonderful.
Yeah, I think it's a wrong adjustment to become vegan as a devotee. I just think there's something wrong with that, personally. I don't think it's a correct adjustment. And it's not about 40 years ago, Prabhupada's talking about a situation where milk, it, you know, so you avoid the toxic or the, you know, the, but you can find even commercial milk in the health food stores, there's, you know, you can do a little research and you'll find that there's some farmers that outside of the devotional community that are actually dealing with the cows differently than the mechanistic, you know, mainstream dairy association.
That's a good point. I should maybe look a little harder over here. I just, a good point. Well taken.
But the point is, though, that almost all of them kill the cows in the end when they're not usable. Almost none of them retire them, as far as I know. Even Clover Dairy hear the same thing.
Yeah, when I was in California, we found some people that took care of cows, that, you know, that weren't devotees. Anyway,
yeah.
I'm just
let's go on, because I have a few more points here. So let's go ahead to slide number 12 then. Okay. Prabhupada says, the Brahmanas therefore are required to know the Vedas, or the ultimate source of knowledge. So from the basis of scriptural standards, then we can actually make decisions about these things. And so what sources do we have in terms of these Vedas? And I listed here Bhagavad Gita, of course, you know, talks about a little bit about Varnashram. You know, this is the basic ideas, Chaturvarnya Mayashristam. Guna Karma Vibhaga Shaha. That was 411. Somewhere there. Yeah. And then, of course, later on in the 18th chapter, there is discussion of Shama Dhamma Tapo Socham Shanti Arjuna Eva Cha. Yeah. And the more details. But in Srimad Bhagavatam, practically speaking, I would say that most of Srimad Bhagavatam is Daivi Varna Ashram Dharma. Yeah. Bhagavatam has kind of a fast route, which the nectar of devotion kind of pulls out. Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu pulls out the fast track. But if you want to kind of take your time, there's more details than about different examples of people, like pregnancy of Diti in the evening, Kashyapa and Kardama, and how they got married in different ways, and the ladies and stuff, and how all these things can actually be very, you know, progressive to cultivate spiritual life in a very, you know, healthy pace. You may not become a pure devotee in 6 years, but you will become a devotee in 36 years. Okay. So much detail about Varna Ashram in the Bhagavatam, and just so many purports would probably point out, this is Kshatriya Dharma, this is Stri Dharma, like that. There's a lot of work to actually organize that into different collections in terms of different topics and stuff like that. Then there's the Dharma Shastras, and these are, I think, mentioned as something like 11 prominent or 81. And of course, Prabhupada in the instructions by Vishnudeva Yudhisthira, in those purports, he mentions Manu Samhita and Parashara's Dharma Shastra. And I think someplace else he also mentions Yajnavalkya. So Manu Samhita is supposed to be more for the Satya Yuga or something. And the standard is very high. And the Parashara's Dharma Shastra is supposed to be more for Kali Yuga. So I tried to find it. Maybe I mentioned this before. It was a whole adventure. I went to the University of California library, and these librarians, they have 1 million books, you know. So the librarians got really enthusiastic. It was a real, like, you know, fun search. They're using all their tools. And they got copies coming back, but they're all in Devanagari. So finally, one librarian screamed, "Oh, I've got it. You know, okay. And there was one copy in English in the Bolt Hall Law Library. You know, Bolt Hall is the law school. So I walked across the grass and came to Bolt Hall and started looking for the call number. And it was down in the basement, all in a cement basement with these light. And one shelf was Hindu law, you know. So I started looking for the specific title, and then this door opened up in the cement wall, and this guy came out and was locking his door, and he says, "Oh, do you know Sanskrit?" Right? So, well, a little. And he kind of winked and said, "So do I." He walked away. So I don't know who he was. But I found that there was one little copy published in 1896 by the Asiatic Society, and apparently no other copy has been done, no other translation has been done, because it was so good. And we have it on our website. Our website is bhati.org, B-H-A-T-I. Kind of like bhakti without the Krishna, without the K. bhati.org. And that's our Neos place. And you can find some different things there. You can also find Parashara's Dharma Shastra. And I actually, because it's for Kali Yuga, there's some very specific, interesting, useful advice about remarriage. And is it proper for a girl to take a second husband? So very interesting discussions there. Very practical. And after that, I even noticed, like in some room conversations, when Prabhupada was giving advice, practical advice, he was actually quoting, you know, from Parashara's Dharma Shastra. So that's there. Then, of course, we also have Hitopadesha and Panchit Tantra, which give very good advice, you know, about how to deal with things. The Bhishma Stuti is the, it's in the Shanti Parva, the end, after everything is finished in the Battle of Kurukshetra. And that's when Krishna asks Bhishma Deva with the bed of arrows to give instructions on Varna Ashram Dharma to Yudhisthira. He says to Bhishma Deva, "You're leaving in a few days, sometime, and I'm not happy because you're taking all this knowledge with you. You know all the knowledge of all the other acharyas, and generally speaking, as far as our readings, even as all scholars of the Vedas say that, practically speaking, it's very difficult to surpass Bhishma Deva's instructions there in terms of being the best, you know, description of Varna Ashram and all the Vedas." So it's about 135 pages of 10-point type, I think, in the Ganguly thing. And Prabhupada summarizes it in two purports in the ninth chapter. where Bishop, it just says Bishop David instructed you to hear about this and that. And the purport then probably gives a little amplification, you know, based upon the Bhishma Stuti. And it's like every single sentence is a super concentrated thing about what is the role of women, what is the purpose of the Gurukula. And if we just like read those and contemplated what they implied, you know, so many, you know, problems in ISKCON and everything else we could have avoided like that. So the Bhishma Stuti is another great source. Then Hansaduta said, the Prabhupada said, we could teach Shakespeare in the Gurukula. He said, if you want to understand word power, you know, read Shakespeare. So much of Shakespeare includes all his discussions about Varna Ashram in our Western setting. This whole topic about remarriage, for example, is a big topic in Hamlet. The main topic is about how his uncle killed his father and should he get revenge or not. You know? But a second topic was that his mother then also, married her brother-in-law very quickly, you know. And Hamlet says that the cooked meats at the funeral feast did but do double duty as cold cuts at the wedding feast. So her husband's body wasn't even cold before she was in bed with her brother-in-law, you know. And then to try and like, you know, ferret her out or teach her, he has this theater troupe, which has come to Dunsinore, put on a play, which will, you know, see if the king responds to the murder and send, also show his mother, like, you know, preach to her about what she's doing. And so in the play, the old king says, well, I'm going to be dying soon, you know, and you should go ahead and get remarried. And the young queen says, oh, no, I'll never remarry, this and that. And one of the lines is, she says, they say that a woman who kisses a second husband in bed murders the first one twice. It's heavy. Yeah. We do this in the comparison to Bhagavad Gita. We have a whole spy show called Hamlet and Arjuna. And it works so nicely. Afterwards, we sell Bhagavad Gita very nicely. Yeah. And we even have one girl who was approved. We did it all in Spanish in South America to start with. So there we have the poetry of Shakespeare and the poetry of Vedavyas, and such, so touching, so potent. So we have one girl, our disciple, she studied professionally as an actress. So she started playing the player queen in the drama, and she broke down. She couldn't handle it. It was just like so intense, you know, the communication about what is remarriage and everything else like that. So very, very good discussions in Shakespeare and reading these things to touch Western audiences and to communicate with them. And again, we've done this one thing of Hamlet and Arjuna, but another one, a very good one, is the Taming of the Shrew. You can just put that on as, like, you know, for the Grihastha community in your place there, with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. And it was like they were born to play those roles. It's just like this kind of whole perfection of their lives, you know, the two of them carrying on like that, Taming of the Shrew. And it's really funny and very, like, you know, inspiring for a good understanding of what is Grihastha Ashram, what are our roles, how are we supposed to carry on. And finally, we have here, of course, Chanaka Nidhi. And Chanaka Bhatt gives so much advice, you know, about Varna Ashram and the king and so on. So we may want to teach Vastu, we may want to teach Ayurveda, we may want to teach Gandharva Veda, but the thing we have the most resources immediately is Danda Veda. Bishop Dev calls it Danda Veda because the king has the danda to chastise people, the rod. So right away, if somebody wants a curriculum, we can assign them, we can give, you know, research projects for master's and PhD thesis that people can start doing, and give so much advice all over the world about how to deal with the relationships between men and women, between the laborers and the capitalists, you know, proper defense, and even to the point of this point about racial purity that's coming up because we're doing the fifth canto now, is that our perspective is racist, you know, but in a very rational sense that, yeah, different people have different qualities because they're born in different races. And they should be in certain places globally, and otherwise it's going to create problems. And so in Europe, Vidyananda Maharaj is saying, now before, of course, there was this genocide over racism going on. But people said, no, we're going to stick with multinational, multi-ethnic culture. But now the Prime Minister of Germany, the lady, has formally said it's a failure, it's just not working. And 80% of the people in France are voting, you know, to send all the Muslims and Arabs who are coming from Africa in back to Africa. You know? Okay, it's a controversial topic, like polygamy. And so we have to research, as brahmanas, what the Bhagavatam or Prabhupada actually says. At this point, my reading is that Prabhupada says, yes, we have to accept. Being born in a white body, you've got certain advantages and disadvantages. Black body, you've got advantages and disadvantages. Woman's body, yeah. And this is Varnashram. And when they're all connected, black people, white people, red people, orange people, women, men, children, adults, old people, properly in Varna Ashram, then it creates a place of peace and prosperity, you know, for progressive spiritual life. Okay, next slide there. It's the last one we got. Number 13. And this is kind of like, we've been listening during the week here, we had some comments we noted, like Prabhupada Maharaj, Bhakti Prabhupada Vrata Damodar Maharaj. He mentioned Michael Behe, and I went to the old Wikipedia there, which is not all that reliable, but usually pretty good. And it's very interesting, you know, because he's one of maybe like three to five people who are prominent as being Western credentialed people, academically credentialed people who are fully supporting of, what is it, creation, you know, a creationist point of view. You know, it's very interesting, his biography and stuff like that. And there are, because Maharaj is presenting that he just kind of like devastates the community, but there are many, this one after another, like responses criticizing his point of view, and it may be true or maybe not. But we can still see that definitely that the Wikipedia page is Wikipedia, it's the common people. So, yeah, he comes across as having good points, you know, and stuff like that. But there also, there's this one after another responses to it. This whole thing about evolution, there's another article by George J. Stein. It's called, quote, Biological Science and the Roots of Nazism. And that was in the magazine American Scientist, Volume 76, Number 1, January, February, 1998. And I always remember that because it's a very nice article. And he goes into this point that at one point people were thinking, yeah, we figured out where the species came from, biological selection. And, okay, so therefore the same thing can be applied to society, that those societies which survive, those cultures and races, that's the only justification necessary. And it goes through a whole history how this became a large basis of the whole Nazi ideology and philosophy, which allowed them or motivated them to exterminate, you know, different races, not just Jews, but other people, because they thought it was like exterminating a disease from the body. So very much these ideas do go to a very practical reality. And we have to fight them in the level of ideas to becoming educated. In general, this whole area on the YouTube, I found so many, you know, interesting sources. Of course, the most famous person, Richard Dawkins, he's a head biologist at Oxford and quite a successful biologist. I think he was a Christian before, like that. But then he's become, which very commonly mentioned, a rabid, you know, anti-Christian, pretty much, because he doesn't deal with other forms of creationism like that, you know. And he had one book called The God Delusion. I think it was called The God Delusion. So then Alistair McGrath, who's the head theologian at Oxford, he's retired now, And theoretically, theoretically, the head theologian is actually the head scholar, traditionally. So he wrote a book called The Dawkins Delusion. And that, again, very powerful discussion. He said, I'm not going to talk about God. He said, God's a very good topic, but it takes the strategy the Prabhupada said we should do, which is not go beyond Paramatma. There is matter, there is Atma, and Atma can be divided into Paramatma and Jivatma, the hand of God, like that. But we're not going to go into more specifics than other than that. Yeah. And then he pretty much, again, I think there it is, a very strict destruction of Dawkins' points from a theological and philosophical point of view, pointing out the many problems he has in all of his arguments. Radhika said when they crossed on the campus, you know, they would say, you know, Graf would say Dawkins, and Dawkins would say McGrath, on the same camp. So right in Oxford, these things were going on. Then here in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, has the oldest teachers' college, maybe like 12,000 students studying teaching. They brought somebody from the National Academy of Science. His name was Jay Lenoff or something, which is, you know, the National Academy is the government's science thing. And I went there, and maybe like about 200 people was in the evening, packed up in a best auditorium. Two deans were there, like that. And he made a very good presentation. He basically, what he was saying is that about 15 years ago, they did a survey, and it came back something like about, you know, 18% of the population believes that God created life. And something similar like 18% of the population believe that you know, we were created from matter. Okay, the other 64% of the population didn't give a damn like that. That was their result of actually the investigation. So they went about a whole program of educating people, everything else. And after like 14 years, they came back, and basically it had no impact whatsoever. The same number of people believed the same way. So they were very much considering how to communicate to people what science does and how we arrive at conclusions. We have to. He said that now people take science as revealed knowledge coming from on high, which is exactly what Prabhupada says. He said we have to show them that it's not like that, that they too can understand the process and have faith in it. Then he went ahead and he said they have to understand how we derive the scientific knowledge. And then he said something which is quite revolutionary, and it seems the way things are changing. He said, science is not the only way to know things. At that point, he even like kind of rubbed his eye, like rubbing a tear away, and saying there are many other very nice ways to know things, like that. So I think maybe Prabhupada and all of us have actually had some influence, because they're really accepting that there are other ways to know things. But within their science area, okay, they're very convinced, you know. So there is a change, but still very much, you know, evolution. And a lot of Mars's comments are very true. We accept that. The World Congress book that the BI did, the Bhaktivedanta Institute did in 1984, Synthesis of Science and Religion, has a fantastic summary of the history of science and religion by Harvey Cox, who was, of course, a theologian at Harvard. Wonderful description of the history of how these things have developed and how religion and science have in the past related and how they're related now. Yeah. There's so many things on this. If you start going on the YouTube, so many people talking about them. One of them I'm going to finish off with is that and it may be, it's not Michael Behe, I've seen this picture now. It's somebody else. I mean, maybe he's like a Jewish scholar or Indian guy. He's a prominent scientist, and interviewing him. And he says that the idea of evolution is that mutations produce more information. But he said there's not one known case of an actual mutation improving things. It always gives less information. And sometimes that allows for, you know, a species to exist better. So then the same interviewer a little bit later is talking to Dawkins. And during the interview, which is kind of like not threatening, you know, he finally comes to this point. He says, Professor Dawkins, do you know of any mutation which actually has produced more information? Now, Dawkins is a super heavyweight biologist. He knows biology. So in the video, he's like sitting there and kind of like, you see, he's thinking, you know, and thinking, and thinking, and then he changes the subject like that. And it's very obvious, you know, that he's basically saying that I don't know of any case. You know? So anyway, on the philosophical level, on the actual mechanistic level of how it works, there's more and more information now to discuss this at that. So another point about Hiranyagarbha, but I don't think it's really time to discuss that. Yeah. So I think that's all we have then. So thank you very much. All glory to the Prabhupada. At this point, we turn control of our program back over to our host and hope his Stepford has been cured.
Thank you so much, Maharaj. Wonderful class. If everybody is unmuted right now, if anybody have any questions or comments for Maharaj?
A good class. I didn't know Dawkins was a Christian.
I'm not sure, but I think he was before. That was the thing. And then he was a theistic guy, and he changed like that and became very fanatical about it.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense. He's really targets. He takes easy targets.
Yeah. And the Christians, they won't load in with us because then they got to accept the incarnation. You know? And that, of course, you know, messes up some of their gratification.
Right. Yeah, the Christians just make a few mistakes. Some of their arguments are good. Some of them, we can pick and choose. I was thinking somebody could, writers often take a name, when they write something, a different name than their own. And we have examples of acharyas like Vishwanath and others that have preached to certain sections, even Bhaktivinoda, has made some pretty interesting comments about that some of the hells, they may be imaginary or whatever, just to adjust to the audience that he's speaking to. So I was thinking, one way to approach these evolutionists who have, who are tenacious, and they do criticize Behi and anybody else. I mean, they'll just attack anybody because it's a hot button issue, because it's their core belief and they're defending it. So I was thinking someone could write something and just, so they wouldn't attack the imagery of the Vedas, pose as sort of an impersonalist, but allude to a personal conception at the same time.
Yeah, I wonder if Behe to some degree is also even doing that. That was McGrath's strategy too. He said, I'm not going to talk about God. It's a good topic, but I'm not going to talk about that in this discussion.
Right.
Just the Paramatma is enough. Actually, Prabhupada said, in the university environment, don't go to Bhagavan. Simply go to what is Prakriti, what is Atma, and they'd explain Paramatma, Jivatma, and then he said after that, if they want to talk personally, okay.
This is Prabhupada?
Yeah, that was his philosophy for the BI, taught him how to preach in the universities.
Oh, he instructed the scientists like that.
Yeah. I've applied that. One time in university, we gave a lecture in South America, and another professor came, really liked it. He said, can you come and talk to my students tomorrow, or two days later? So I went there, and I got there. The guy was really nervous, and he took us in. He said, my chairman department wants to talk to you. And so I went in, and it looked like the chairman was really upset with him for inviting, monks and that kind of stuff. So I talked to the guy, and the guy was a little pacified. Well, okay, let's go ahead. So I went in. It was a big classroom, one of these thrust classrooms, maybe like about 140 students. And I presented the whole Sankhya thing. And the chairman was up, and this lady came in. It looked like she was the dean or something, way up in the back. And this professor was kind of like looking over his shoulder at this. The axe was on the line. And so I stuck exactly that point about Sankhya and presenting all this stuff. And somebody specifically asked me a question about God and this and that, And I said, it's a very nice question. And, of course, obviously I have some thoughts about it. But for this environment and stuff, of course, it's not really practical to just talk about it. But if you want to talk about it later, we can talk about it. So out of the corner of my eye, I was kind of looking up at the dean and the head of the department. And they both were smiling very broadly and nodding their heads up and down like that. Yes, you took care of that very nicely.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So they, I think that's it. even most people in America believe in God, but the people that control the media don't. And so most people think it's not proper to talk about it. People shouldn't don't believe in God. But you talk to them individually, personally, then they have a lot of questions and inspiration and enthusiasm.
I mean, Prabhupada himself, he published Reservoir of Pleasure. He's giving Krishna at the front end. But is there anything in the folio that, directly where Prabhupada's talking like this to the scientists? They should go as far as possible.
Of course, the life comes from life. In the dialogues with Bhakti Sudhamana Maharaj, there he has him pose as a scientist.
Right. Okay.
It's also a strategy in other areas too, not just within science, other areas too. I think generally the university atmosphere, Prabhupada's talking about Paramatma, and that's about all they can handle. Personally, you can talk to people, but when you start getting into the institution is set up, at least it was set up then, where, talking, some prison guy, he was talking with this guy in prison, he was a chaplain, he had an incredible library, this incredible theological library, the devotees books and everything else, the prisoners had organized them. He was talking to us, and he said, somebody asked me, he said, Reverend Bob, where can I learn about God? And he said, I thought about it. He said, the most bizarre thing came to my mind was that because if you try and talk about God in the schools outside, you'll be, if you do it forcibly, you'll be arrested. If you push the issue, you'd be physically taken out of the school.
Yeah, it's illegal.
He said, but in the prison, actually, they're encouraging us to teach people about God. So he said, the most bizarre thing is that if you want to learn about God, you have to go to jail.
Interesting.
Yeah. But I guess maybe we should end here and all go back to Godhead today. Why not? Why wait? Yeah.
See
the baby ki jai. Shri Bhagavan jai. Jayananda Prabhu ki jai. Hare Krishna.
Jai. Hari Bol.
Hari Bol.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Nara.
Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol.
Yeah, Shiva Prabhupada.
Hari Bol. Hari Krishna. Thank you.